You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Max toku ingoa, no mai haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā Upper Wednesday. I'm your host Max and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Manny. Efai Akine, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez March about Prime Minister Christopher Luxon's trip to Southeast Asia, where he met with multiple world leaders, the Green Party's plans to call for evidence-based cannabis regulation, the government's new draft school curriculum for years 0 to 10, and Education Minister Erica Stanford announcing plans to shrink the teaching council. And I spoke to John Minto, co-chair of Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa, to discuss the recent state of the Gaza ceasefire, almost 4 weeks since it came into effect, as well as the news of an Israeli military lawyer being arrested after she admitted to leaking the August 2024 videos of Israeli soldiers. Manny, what do you have for us today?
I spoke with Glenn Barkley, chairperson of Tax Justice Aotearoa and the Better Taxes for a Better Future campaign about Labour's limited capital gains tax proposal. And I also spoke with Chris Puluvia, senior lecturer at the Auckland University of Technology, about the current measles outbreak in Aotearoa.
He aho o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pā tuhi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wareware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō, he pakeheri, roki mā runga I te pai, tukutuku o irirangi pōhō, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
Over recent weeks, Prime Minister Christopher Luxon has been busy touring Southeast Asia in the hopes of negotiating various trade deals and securing meetings with other world leaders. In his returning press conference where he recapped his trip, the Prime Minister focused on the importance of securing a one-on-one meeting with US President Donald Trump. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, I spoke to him about the Prime Minister's trip. We also discussed the Green Party's plans for an evidence-based cannabis regulation and whether they would campaign with that policy for next year's election, as well as the new draft school curriculum released by the government and the subsequent plans to shrink the teaching council. But first, we discussed whether Luxon's trip to Southeast Asia was a success or not.
I think when it comes to economic benefits to a country, time will tell, but what was really concerning was him greasing up to Trump, making jokes about, you know, even his hair, and not raising any of the serious issues that we should be challenging him on the global stage, such as his track record on supporting a genocide, the state of our democracies, as well as ensuring that, for example, the way in which Trump has conducted his tariffs ultimately end up affecting some pretty low-income communities across the globe. And so when we see Luxon simply cozying up and making jokes with a global leader undermining democracy, increasing inequality, and supporting a genocide, it just shows that we don't have strong leadership in the global stage.
Would you regard that as important, that that's something that the Prime Minister of New Zealand should be doing?
New Zealand has a strong track record of taking a principled position on the global stage, and no matter our size, we have a duty to stand up for what is right, and that includes the interests of people here in Aotearoa as well as across the globe. And when I see Luxon cozying up to someone like Trump, who is increasingly authoritarian, and not challenging him on important issues, it shows that we're losing that principled and strong voice that we have on the global stage.
The Prime Minister seems to be promoting the one-on-one meeting with US President Donald Trump as hugely significant. Is that something that you'd agree with?
I think for him, hugely significant means handshaking and photo ops without any substance. I think if we can't see Luxon genuinely building a relationship with world leaders in which we hold true to our principles, we won't be getting anywhere, and all that we will continue doing so is being pushover for increasingly authoritarian regimes. Whether it's China, whether it's the US, or any other country that has a poor track record of human rights, we have a duty to be a strong voice on those issues. And if the government is so concerned about their actions in relationship to things like tariffs, what we should be doing is building economic resilience here in New Zealand by, for example, investing in our manufacturing sector and not being so reliant on volatile world leaders that could throw us under the bus at any point because they just simply stop liking us.
When recapping his trip through Southeast Asia, the Prime Minister extended an offer for President Trump to visit New Zealand in the future and said we should certainly welcome him here. Is that something that the Green Party would do as well?
We would absolutely not be welcoming Donald Trump on our shores. We should not be welcoming a leader that has an increasingly authoritarian record, that has been vocally supporting a genocide. And instead, there are ways to build ties with communities across the United States that do not rely on giving an authoritarian leader a free pass.
Moving on to the next topic, Chloe Swarbrick announced that the Green Party has renewed its call for evidence-based cannabis regulation on the fifth anniversary of a referendum in which the public voted only narrowly against legalization. Swarbrick also announced that the Green Party is launching an online platform for New Zealanders to define what they think sensible regulation could look like. My next question is, why do the Green Party think cannabis should be legalized and why now?
Well, because our war on drugs is failing and the drugs are winning the war on the war on drugs. We've seen that despite prohibition, harm is increasing in our communities, and that we have seen other countries that have taken a different approach and have been able to reduce the harm that drugs cause in our communities. All the evidence shows that we should be treating drugs as a health issue as opposed to a criminal issue, because when we treat it as a criminal issue, we prevent people seeking help when they need it, we prevent adequate information coming out in our communities in a way that genuinely reaches out those that are most at risk of the harm that substances can cause, and that includes cannabis. And, you know, it's time that we also address the contradictions on how we treat some substances versus others. We know that substances like alcohol cause a huge amount of harm, and yet we recognize that prohibition isn't, for example, an adequate way to address alcohol harm. We should be doing the exact same thing for drugs like cannabis.
If a cannabis legalization policy were to be solely decided by the Green Party, what would the regulations be?
Well, the regulations put forward in the referendum show that we can put in place regulations that put public health at the center of it, as opposed to models like the ones that we have seen in places like California that allow corporates to effectively make a huge profit in the same way that they're doing it with tobacco and alcohol at the expense of public health. And so for us, that would be about ensuring that we have strong regulations that protect corporations from leading the way on the types of cannabis that are being sold in the market, but also ensuring that the growth of cannabis remains within the public good and not for corporations who take over to make profits over, which is what we've seen overseas in jurisdictions where lack of adequate regulations have indeed caused harm instead of putting public health at front and center. And we've seen how places like Portugal and Uruguay have led more the way in terms of putting public health at the center as opposed to places like California.
Once the Green Party have heard New Zealanders' feedback on what the regulations should be, will those regulations then be part of your campaigning for next year's election?
Well, we have had a long-standing position that the legalization of cannabis and treating all drugs as a health issue is well overdue. And so we are really looking forward to hearing people's feedbacks on what these regulations should look forward. And we look also forward to continuing to campaign on the legalization of cannabis, as we have done for over a decade by now. And this is a much, much overdue issue to reduce harm in our communities, to put public health at the center of our decision-making, and to stop the contradiction of how we choose to treat some drugs as a health issue and others as a criminal issue.
Have you heard from other political parties as well to see who might support the Green Party with this policy?
That is work that will absolutely be taken underway as we get close to the election and we start negotiating with other parties. But I do challenge every political party to stop treating drugs as a criminal issue and to take an evidence-based approach and start treating drugs as a health issue.
All right, moving on to the final topic. The government released their full draft of the new curriculum for Year 0 to 10 students. Despite a lot of criticism, Education Minister Erica Stanford called it another step toward delivering a world-leading system for every learner. Since this announcement, Erica Stanford has also announced plans to shrink the teaching council. Firstly, what was the Green Party's reaction to the new curriculum announced by the government?
We've heard it loud and clear that teachers across the country acknowledge that this does not focus on the issues that our kids need to be successful in schools. And the main challenge we've had isn't the curriculum. There's been quite a lot of changes already over the past few years when it comes to how teachers do their work. And if Erica thinks that by simply loading teachers with a pretty overwhelming curriculum is going to make a huge difference for our children, she's ignoring the fact that right now, one of the key reasons why we have, you know, people not showing up to school, people not feeling like they're performing well in school, is because we're sending our kids to school hungry, and we're sending our kids home to cold, damp homes and environments that don't provide adequate support in order for our kids to thrive in the education space. And so we support the teachers who have pushed back on this new curriculum, and we encourage the government to ensure that they work with teachers to design an education system that puts the learning conditions of our kids at the forefront.
According to the Association for Māori Principals and Education Leaders, the government's curriculum makes Māori invisible and is not fit for purpose. Does the Green Party share that view?
Our education system should reflect our unique culture that we have here in Aotearoa. To continue to invisibilize Te Reo Māori and Te Tiriti within our education space, all that it will do is actually erase our rich history, our rich identity, one that I think is shared by Māori and non-Māori alike in terms of how we value it. And what it does as well is that by erasing the ability for kids to genuinely learn and appreciate our unique identity, we also deprive them from the ability to reconnect with their culture, with our history, and that in and of itself does lead to poor outcomes later down the line. And so, you know, sure, numeracy and literacy are important skills for people to learn. They're critical, but we cannot at the same time be erasing the things that makes us unique in Aotearoa within our education space.
The curriculum also removes the requirement to teach Aotearoa New Zealand's histories. What do you make of that move by the government, and is that something that should be seen as essential?
Our history is critical to supporting people to understand why things are the way they are right now. So, for example, why is it that we have such high rates of homelessness? And who led through history decisions that have created the economic conditions where there are not enough jobs, where Māori face land dispossession? Those are all things that people should be learning at school so that they can then have the tools to make good decisions in adulthood and make decisions on, for example, who they want to elect with a good understanding of the past. And when the curriculum includes issues of global history but neglects to center Aotearoa's history within the curriculum, it just shows that the government does not value our unique identity, our unique history, and is quite happy to erase the past in order for the government to pretend that we do not have historical issues that are yet to be addressed, such as the harms that colonization and neoliberalism have caused in our communities.
What are the main aspects of the new curriculum that the Green Party would change?
We would recenter Te Tiriti and Te Reo Māori within our curriculum, as well as ensuring that we would have a focus on people having access to learning civics and history of the history of Aotearoa. But beyond that, if we want an education system that puts the learning conditions of our students at the forefront, what we would do is addressing issues like child poverty. What we would do is ensuring that we invest in quality lunches in our schools, and that we support our teachers to have adequate staffing levels and that their working conditions are well supported so that students have the best opportunity to do well in school and later down in life.
And just quickly moving on to the teaching council aspect, teachers' unions have slammed the government's move to shrink the teaching council as a blatant power grab. Do you agree with that?
Our teaching councils should be led by people who are actually who actually understand our education system, and that needs to include teachers. Any attempts to push aside teachers and learners from decision-making within our schools completely undermines the people who are actually at the forefront and at the front line of our education system. And so it is a really concerning move to see the government continuing through this and other reforms to erase the voices of our educators within decisions in our education system.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez march on Prime Minister Christopher Luxon's Southeast Asia trip, the Green Party's plans for cannabis regulation, the new draft school curriculum, and Education Minister Erica Stanford's plans to shrink the teaching council.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez march.
Because that's the big deal here. Dolphin orgies.
The Wire.
Over the past few months, unions have been sounding the alarm about the state of our healthcare system as the government cuts funding and reduces staff numbers. Now, a new threat has emerged that risks stretching our resources thinner. A measles outbreak has reared into the community with cases climbing to 17 in just a week, with thousands potentially exposed. To understand how much of a risk the outbreak is likely to pose to the country, I spoke to senior lecturer at the Auckland University of Technology, Chris Pulauvia. Just to begin with, could I get you to break down for our listeners who might not know much about it what measles is?
Measles is a condition, very debilitating condition, that's caused by the measles virus. And the measles virus can cause a runny nose, hacking cough, fever, sore throats and headaches and body aches. But it's also can be characterized by having rashes on your body inside the mouth, and it can be very debilitating for children when they catch the virus, especially those who are not vaccinated.
And how serious is this recent outbreak in Aotearoa?
I would say that it's serious enough for us to be concerned about for a number of reasons. Measles, the virus itself, is very, very contagious. It's far more contagious compared to the flu and COVID. We've seen in the past that COVID, one sick person can infect up to four people. But with the measles virus, one sick person can infect up to 18 other people. And so not only that, but the virus could spread in little droplets just by people talking, coughing, sneezing, and it could remain in the air for up to 2 hours. And so in highly congregated areas, populated areas, the measles virus can stay in the air for a very, very long time, and that can increase the chances of people getting sick. But not only that, not only is the measles contagious, our vaccination rates here in Aotearoa, where we need to be, is not quite there yet. We need to be at the 95% vaccination level to be able to achieve this community immunity, to really protect those who can't get vaccinated.
What level of vaccination are we at currently?
That's a good question. I don't have the numbers on me at the moment, but I believe maybe around the 70% mark. But I think what's most important is the number of people that can't get vaccinated. And I would think that this would be in the several hundred thousand across the country. And those are the people that we need to protect. And so there's a lot of people that can't get it, and we're not quite at the level that we need to be, which is at the 95% level. And this information, I think, we need to be able to look at and review, to be able to find out different pockets across the country where the vaccination rates are quite low.
Who tend to be the most vulnerable impacted people with conditions, or perhaps communities, that we really need to be thinking about when we think about how measles might be impacting us as a country?
Yeah, I have a particular focus on Maori and Pacific people. People with underlying health conditions are obviously more susceptible. And the people that have, may say, have issues getting access to a doctor or pharmacy, where they can, you know, get vaccinated. I think those are the some of the tricky challenges that some people currently face at the moment.
And how can people help reduce transmission and protect themselves and protect others? What are some ways?
Yeah, we've had some key learnings during COVID-19, and I think you know, the public should be aware of that now. You know, if you're feeling sick or have symptoms, you know, it's always good to wear a mask. And if you're unwell, feel unwell, it's really important to self-isolate until, you know, you get some, until you get better. Also getting vaccinated, I think, you know, this is the message that we want to keep sending home is getting vaccinated, and that's our best protection.
Obviously, the MMR vaccine is oftentimes given to children, and that will probably cover a lot of people who are out there. For those people who might be a bit vaccine hesitant, I might have thought it wasn't needed when they were a kid or when they last got it offered by their doctor. What would you say to them now, given the current circumstances?
Yeah, I think this is very important for the parents. I know that there are a couple of reasons why, you know, people might be hesitant. Due to some, you know, misinformation, there's been some misinformation around in association with autism, and I'd just like to say that this has since been debunked. It's been proven to be wrong several times by large-scale scientific studies and extensive studies too. And so we know that there is no association there. And some of the other things that may cause sort of vaccine hesitancy is reliable information. And I think this is something for our parents to really be able to stay on top of. You know, we know what we've learned this during COVID, where sources of information are not reliable, such as Facebook and TikTok and other social media platforms. There are reliable sources of information, and you could also speak to your doctor as well. But also, just to add to that, the MMR vaccine, you know, we've had this vaccine for quite a long time now. We know that it's reliable. We know that it works very, very well. And so it's that should give our parents some confidence in getting our kids vaccinated.
Awesome. Thank you very, very much. Is there anything else you'd like to add to the conversation before we wrap up?
Yeah, I just want to sort of reemphasize that, and I hate to be sort of doom and gloom, but measles is really bad news. A significant proportion of those who are unvaccinated and get measles are more likely to receive hospital care. And at the moment, our hospitals are, you know, are trying to manage, you know, our current situation. And if we were to add more to that, that would be, you know, cause some troubles. But there are also long-term consequences of getting measles with, you know, in those who are not vaccinated, and that's immune memory loss. And so that's where, you know, you've got your memory cells in your body that remembers previous infections, and measles virus can actually infect those cells and kill them, so that you your immune system can't remember previous infections. So in the future, it makes you more susceptible to infections that you've received in the past. So it's really, really bad news. And I would encourage our parents, if you're not sure whether you're vaccinated yourself or whether your kids are not vaccinated, contact your family doctor and they'll be able to give you more information. And if you're not sure yourself, there's no harm in getting another full course of the MMR vaccine. And I think if we can do that, we'd be able to protect our whānau, give them the best chance, the healthiest chance of at life that we can. And just really encourage everyone, take some time out and get on top of it. Get yourself checked and enjoy, so that we can all enjoy summer together.
Perhaps for people thinking about vaccinations, how long does a normal course last in its efficacy?
So it's very, very effective. You only need two doses of the MMR vaccine. But if you're not sure, you can get it a full course again. So you can get the two shots about 4 weeks apart. And it's about 99% effective at protecting you from getting measles. But also, it's very, very good at stopping you from spreading it. So if you're vaccinated, you get measles, the quality of the virus that you spread is very, very not very good at all, and so that's a good thing. That prevents the spread of the virus.
That was Chris Buliovia, Senior Lecturer at the Auckland University of Technology, discussing the current measles outbreak. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Garth! Garth! Where's your hat? No hat, no play.
I don't have one, sir.
Then go on and pick a hat from Lost Property.
Oh, sir, those hats all have nits.
It's nits or melanoma, Garth.
It's a no hat, no play summer. So it's lucky 95BFM have you sorted with sweet merch for your noggins. Choose from four designs, two classic cap designs, one cord design, and a bucket hat. Pre-order yours now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out! He says he knows a spot?
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Mini Haha is original.
Oh, thank God! It's a beer spot! I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7 p.m. every weekday, only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the Beer Spot, your tappy place.
The original originator.
95. Go to 95BFM.com for show podcasts.
Yeah!
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know any and all of your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. National elections are a year away, and polling suggests that Labour has surpassed National to become the most popular party. But it would likely need to gain further support if they wish to form a government. One of the top issues for voters is healthcare, and their first policy, and in the first policy release in the lead up to their election campaign, Labour is proposing funding three free GP visits with a limited capital gains tax. They say this should improve our national health, reducing the number of hospital visits, whilst also directing investment away from the housing market and into productive local businesses. I spoke with Glenn Barkley, chairperson of Tax Justice Aotearoa and the Better Taxes for a Better Future campaign, about Labour's limited capital gains tax proposal.
Okay, so this morning I want to talk about Labour's capital gains tax proposal. Could you lay out for our listeners what a capital gains tax is to begin with?
A capital gains tax is a tax essentially on the income gained from the sale of assets. So the obvious ones Labour's policy concentrates on, this is around property, but capital gains taxes overseas tend to be much more comprehensive than what Labour is planning here. And would tax things like sale of shares, other large assets like artworks or stuff like that.
Could you detail for our listeners the exact limitations that are being proposed with Labour's capital gains tax?
Well, essentially, it's just a property tax and a limited one at that. So, as I was saying, a comprehensive capital gains tax, which many countries overseas would have, would cover all forms of significant assets, should have, you know, apply to companies and trusted own assets and so forth. But here, Labour is just proposing that it will apply to investment properties, so a second home. The family home would be exempt, a farm would be exempt, commercial property would be brought into it, and that the gains on the sale of those assets would be taxed at the rate of 28%.
I'd love to get into your opinion on this. Do you feel this is adequate? Would you prefer a more comprehensive capital gains tax? How do you feel about it?
Our response to this was that we were very disappointed. It was very unambitious. We know the challenges that we face around, for example, climate change, addressing the huge inequality in our country, addressing our healthcare system crisis. All these things require revenue. And Treasury and Inland Revenue have both done reports recently that indicate that we have a fiscal problem and that we are not collecting enough revenue to fund the services that we want as a nation. And if something's not done about it, then we could be in real trouble a decade or two down the track. So we think that we need to move now and we need to have a comprehensive capital gains tax. Having said all of that, you know, part of the problem is how the public perceive taxes generally and capital gains taxes in particular. We think that, you know, parties could show better leadership on this, but nonetheless, I understand why Labour has taken a narrower approach, because they want to make a small target. So that being the case, we at least have the opportunity of getting a CGT, however limited, across the line that hopefully can be built on and expanded upon in the future.
So you feel like in general this is a small but positive step, yeah?
Yes, or a positive but small step.
Yeah. I know I've heard Chris Hipkins talk about this, that he wanted the policy to focus on reining in the property market a little bit perhaps, and to redirect investment towards more productive private sector investments. Do you agree with him?
Look, I think that there's a major problem for the country. So much of money and investment goes into the housing market rather than the productive economy. I think everyone recognises that's a significant challenge.
And this tax will should have a small positive effect in that regard. I don't think we can overstate the impact. We do know that countries overseas that do have comprehensive capital gains taxes, you know, should still have problems with their property market as well. But in New Zealand's case, we are really we're pretty extreme in that regard. So, anything that will help that is good. But obviously, there's a lot more that would be required to address the housing market as well.
Given that, if you wanted the government to make a Labour government to take bigger steps on tax in the future, would you first and foremost prefer a more comprehensive capital gains tax, or would you prefer something more like a land value tax or a wealth tax? What's your thoughts on those?
We've been developing our own thinking about this, and another debate within Labour was a wealth tax versus a capital gains tax. We didn't see the world in quite that binary fashion. We think that a capital gains tax is the tax we've just got to have when you look around the world and see how much of an outlier we are. So we just need a capital gains tax, but it's not enough on its own to tackle the problems that we face. So we're interested in things like gift and inheritance taxes, what we might call a wealth transfer tax. You know, right now we're in the middle of a massive transfer of wealth between the baby boomer generation and the generations that follow, and that is privileging and advantaging those who already have money. And we also are interested in looking at ways in which we could tax trusts better in this country, because we are huge users of trusts. They're a common tax avoidance tool, and one way of taxing wealth effectively could be to levy a tax on trusts. So those are the kind of things that we're interested in exploring. But we're open to all sorts of ideas. We know that the Greens have got a very interesting tax policy. It would be interesting to see what happens in election year.
And I've seen when grilled on the policy that the issue of inheritance and whether or not properties would be impacted by the property tax post inheriting the property. Do you understand that? Could you elucidate that a little bit?
They have ring-fenced it. You could argue that the transfer of property on the death of someone to a child is a form of income, and it's an effective kind of realization of the asset, but Labour has been very clear and at pains to say no, that's not what would happen. They anticipate the tax on a tax on this form of tax, so they're making sure that they're not vulnerable to that. It's another way in which this is a very narrow form of CGT.
And finally, do you feel like the narrowness of the narrowness of this policy, do you feel like that has a reasonable shot of getting implemented?
Well, obviously, Labour has to get elected in the first instance, if they do, they say they're committed to it, so that they'll make it happen. It would still leave us, though. You know, you might recall in 2023. Inland Revenue Commission research looking at how the wealthiest in our society were taxed compared with the rest of us. And that demonstrated that the wealthiest 311 families in the country had an effective tax rate of 9.4%, whereas the average New Zealander had one of just over 20%. And the fact that capital gains is not effectively taxed in this country was the main contributor to that gap. So this is not going to address that. It stands a good chance of being implemented if Labour gets in, and it offers something we can build on, but it is also very disappointing and it lacks ambition.
Awesome. Glenn Barclay, thank you very, very much. Have a good day.
Okay, cheers, Emmanuel.
That was Glenn Barclay, chairperson of Tax Justice Aotearoa and the Better Futures, or Better Taxes for a Better Futures campaign, discussing Labour's limited capital gains tax proposal. We'll be right back.
just to start something for fun.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Once again, please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. The US brokered ceasefire was signed almost 4 weeks ago and came fully into effect on the 10th of October in Gaza. Here are some of the key events that have happened since this date. On the 14th of October, there were reports of a wave of public executions by Hamas and rival armed groups. The same day, Israel began to limit aid into Gaza once more due to disputes over the remaining hostages. On the 19th of October, two Israeli soldiers were killed in a Rafah explosion. Then Israel retaliated with airstrikes that killed 45 Palestinians. On the 21st of October, US Vice President J.D. Vance said that the ceasefire was in a very good place. On the 29th of October, Israel launched overnight airstrikes into Gaza that killed at least 104 Palestinians. Israel later claimed the attack was to target military infrastructure. Yesterday, Hamas returned the remains of the final three hostages to Israel, and finally yesterday, the former Israeli military advocate general was arrested in Israel for admitting to leaking the August 2024 video of Israeli soldiers committing war crimes. So how valid is this US brokered ceasefire? Well, that's exactly what I discussed with John Minto, co-chair of the Palestine Solidarity Network, Aotearoa.
What did you make of the arrest of the Israeli lawyer, and what does it say about Israel's credibility in the ceasefire and overall conflict?
Well, I think the arrest is an absolute outrage. This was a woman who had the courage to release evidence of the abuse, the sexual abuse of a particular Palestinian detainee. And it's part of a, there's a there's an enormous amount of evidence of the sexual abuse of Palestinian detainees by Israeli forces. And I should point out, these people are not people who have been charged with any offence. They've not been sentenced. They've not been tried. They are simply people picked up by the Israeli military, and in this case and in many other cases, sexually abused by Israeli soldiers. And the irony here is that she released this evidence to try to protect Israeli soldiers from trial in international sort of jurisdictions. For example, if a country already has good processes to hold soldiers to account, then the International Criminal Court is much less likely to get involved and leave it over to the country to do the trial of these people themselves. But her actions completely backfired, and the right wing in Israel simply demanded that these soldiers be exonerated without trial, and that in fact she be arrested instead. So Israel has shown itself completely unable, unwilling, and in fact deliberately unwilling not to try their own people for war crimes. So it means the International Criminal Court in particular must become the centre of attention to hold Israeli soldiers to account.
Yeah, like you mentioned, many Israeli politicians and pundits have labelled the soldiers as heroes, despite the leaked video showing Israel committing war crimes. What does that say about other countries who choose to support Israel?
Well, it shows to countries like New Zealand and other Western countries in particular, as well as the leadership of countries across the Arab world, that there is still no accountability to Israel for anything which it does. I think that's the most important message. Israel, for 77 years, has avoided any accountability, never, ever been held to account. And it's been pointed out again and again that the only reason we see these war crimes mounting up and the death toll of Palestinians and the mass starvation of Palestinians go ahead is because Israel's never been held to account for any of these actions.
The military advocate general said in her resignation letter that she leaked the video to defuse attacks on military investigators and prosecutors who were working on the case against the soldiers. After hearing about the situation, should a foreign government have stepped in and attempted to provide her safety?
Oh, absolutely. I think, there are, within Israel, there are many people who are deeply upset and angry at what their government is doing. They're a small minority, unfortunately, but those people do need protection. I mean, New Zealand, for example, we should welcome here refuseniks, the young Israelis who refuse to serve in their army, which is a genocidal army responsible for the most appalling of war crimes that we've seen this century. I think we need to provide protection for those people. In fact, anyone who is standing up against the Israeli state and facing the wrath of the Israeli state should be given protection by other countries when they seek it.
All right. Moving on, what do you think about the overall credibility of the ceasefire?
Oh, well, it's never been a ceasefire. It's really been a bit of window dressing, really. What it means is that Israel has just reduced the intensity of its attacks on Gaza, but it hasn't ended the war. It's war against the Palestinian people. It hasn't given up its claims to the whole of the Gazan territory for Israeli settlements. They still want to get Palestinians driven out, and they're looking now to use the US plan as a way to maneuver the situation to get those Palestinians, the 2 million Palestinians in Gaza, expelled.
On the 21st of October, after the ceasefire had already been broken numerous times, US Vice President J.D. Vance said the ceasefire was in a very good place and going better than he expected. What's your response to this?
Well, I think the Americans want the ceasefire to hold. Trump wants the ceasefire to hold because it's his plan. And he and the American administration are putting a lot of pressure on Israel to stick to this 20-point plan. So what Israel's doing is it's going about decreasing the intensity of its attacks, and it's really testing the American resolve to implement this 20-point plan, which, of course, Israel wants bits of the plan, but it doesn't want the whole plan at all. As I said, it wants the expulsion of Palestinians from Gaza completely. The problem they've faced is they cannot find another country that is willing to take these people, even with enormous billion-dollar bribes. So, Palestinians, in fact, are going nowhere. They are continuing to resist the Israeli occupation, and I think that is where Palestinians take hope, and that's where people who are supporting the Palestinian struggle take hope as well.
And how should New Zealand respond to the ceasefire, given everything that's happened since it was put in place?
Well, we should be condemning Israel right now for its ongoing attacks, its ongoing killing of Palestinians in Gaza, its ongoing refusal to provide the humanitarian aid, which Israel promised under the ceasefire plan, but it's only delivering one quarter of what it promised. And Israel at the same time is funding these armed gangs within Gaza. It's protecting them in Israeli-controlled areas and using them to conduct assassinations and to try to provoke a civil war within Gaza. So, again, this is one way that Israel is using to destabilize the Palestinian population and try to, you know, say to the world, hey, well, look, you know, these people are always fighting each other. We've just got to get rid of them, find somewhere else for them to go. That's as crude as Israel is approaching this issue. But New Zealand, we should be condemning that, and we should also be condemning what's happening in the West Bank. You know, you've got the olive harvest season underway, and you've got just the horrendous mass attacks on Palestinians harvesting olives on the West Bank. And, you know, in the last 2 years, we've seen over 1,000 Palestinians killed in the West Bank, just shot dead, just murdered by the Israeli Defense Force and by Israeli settlers. These are pogroms against the Palestinian people in the occupied West Bank. And New Zealand should be speaking out. But our government, of course, has done what it's always done, refusing to condemn Israel for anything and simply condemning every act of Palestinian resistance.
And that was John Minto, co-chair of the Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa, on the validity of the US-brokered ceasefire and the arrest of the former Israeli military advocate general.
That was The Wire.
Ko e rā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai, ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, Chris Puliuvia, Senior Lecturer at the University at the Auckland University of Technology, Glenn Barclay, Chairperson of Tax Justice Aotearoa and the Better Taxes for a Better Future, and John Minto, Co-Chair of the Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in to 95BFM. Next up is the Wednesday 1-4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.